Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, July 15th. And here's a roundup of the latest news brought to you by NBC reporters at home and overseas. We turn first to the Middle East, a tremendously important theater of the war. Grant Parr reports from Cairo.
In New York, this is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. Although he wasn't active during the day yesterday, the enemy last night resumed his attack on the Australian defenses west of Alamein. The battle went on through the night and quite probably is continuing today. Again, the Germans sent in tanks in close cooperation with truck-borne infantry. The Nazis have given the Australians little respite since Friday when the Aussies smashed their way 5 miles into the Italian line with unbelievably low casualties. The Axis command knows its flank is threatened and is exerting every effort to end that threat. One of the most encouraging aspects of the present fighting is the success of the Royal Air Force in knocking out tanks. Fighter bombers and other air units destroyed more than 6 tanks yesterday. The day before, they got 5. One attack yesterday virtually annihilated an enemy column consisting of 1 tank, 2 armored cars, and 12 tanks. After the British warplane struck, only 1 truck was left undamaged. Heavy bombers of the American Army Air Corps have been over Libya during the past 2 nights with the RAF. The first night, the combined force blasted Benghazi Harbor, laid 4 bombs close alongside an enemy ship, probably damaging it severely. Last night, along with a mass flight of British medium bombers, the Americans dropped their destructive loads on another Axis supply force, Tobruk. Once again, Allied fighter bombers set a record for the number of attacks in 1 day. Yesterday, they not only bettered all previous records, they smashed them to bits. A friend just back from the front gives a vivid description of these fighter bombers in action. While visiting the most forward of our batteries, he watched the German artillery make a nuisance of itself by dropping a curtain of fire uncomfortably close to our line. It was beautiful to see, he said, but not exactly pleasant. Each shell burst with a tall plume of smoke and sand, like a geyser. A short time later, an artillery officer shouted jubilantly over the telephone to a nearby battery. Congratulations, you are landing right on the Jerry gun. But it soon became apparent that it wasn't British artillery after all. Fighter bombers were seen shuttling in and out, dropping their bombs. The artillery officer was at least partly correct. They were right on the Jerry gun. This is Grant Parr in Cairo returning you to New York.
In the British capital, where it is now 2 o'clock in the afternoon, John McVane is standing by. Go ahead, London.
This is London. Early this morning, British light naval patrol craft had a fight in the dark over near the French coast. They left a loaded German oil tanker blazing from stem to stern. The British patrol vessel intercepted a German convoy off Cherbourg. The tanker was guarded by 2 heavily armed trawlers and at least 3 E-boats. The British craft attacked them at about 100 yards range, damaged both trawlers, burst through the screen, and shelled the tanker at point-blank range. They left her afire, and she was later seen sinking. All the British craft got back safely, and they had no fatal casualties. Mr. Littleton, the Minister of Production, yesterday gave the House of Commons an optimistic picture of British output. There's good ground for such a picture, because from all the evidence you can get, British production is now in high gear. But the British public, in its thinking about production, tends to the view that the proof of the pudding is in the eating. They say, if our production is so great and so efficient, why hasn't our equipment beaten the German equipment in the Middle East? Most people here would say that British aircraft production has been good because the RAF beat the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain and because of the 1,000 bomber raids. On the other hand, they'd say something was radically wrong with tank and gun production because the British didn't win the Battle of Libya. Some experts believe that British production isn't elastic enough, that no real interchange of production ideas between Britain and America is yet in operation, and that British industrialists and engineers are slow in adopting American mass production methods. To balance this, you have the fact that the British have done a lot that they don't talk about. Yesterday, a British expert, who was in a position to know the facts, told me that about 3 weeks ago, he made an investigation of British and American armaments output. He asserted that at that time, Britain had shipped to Russia more planes, tanks, and guns, things that go bang, is the way he phrased it, than Britain herself had received from America under the Leaseland Agreement. This same expert, who has access to figures that correspondents here can't see, says British production chiefs believe Britain is now producing just about as much armaments as Germany, a nation twice as large. It's thought that this year, American production will be something over half again larger than Britain's, and in 1943, about three times as great, which of course it should be, considering the relative population. All this is tremendous to think about, but it's the amount of material on the particular battlefield at a particular time that counts. 100 planes in Texas or 1,000 tanks in Kansas are going to have precisely no effect at a moment when a battle is being won or lost on the Volga, the Nile, or the Meuse. The Daily Mirror today says of Mr. Littleton's speech, "On drive the panzer columns while we plan. The Germans are not waiting for slow starters to catch up." Mr. Littleton's confidence suggests that in the next few weeks, we may be encouraged by action, by achievement, and not merely by words. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Now across the ocean, Martin Agronsky is the NBC reporter covering developments at General MacArthur's headquarters in Australia. We switch you there now.
This is Martin Agronsky with General MacArthur's headquarters. After 2 days of all quiet on this front, the Air Force broke the lull yesterday with a light and first attack on the Japs at Kalabari, a small fishing port on Ellor Island off the northwest tip of Timor. An equally light attack was made by our bombers on the airdrome runway at Salamura, the Japs' New Guinea base to the northeast of Australia. The Japs did nothing for the third day running, and the position in the southwest Pacific still remains static. All attention here centers on Russia for the moment, on board fences, on factory walls, and even on the pavement. Pro-Russian sympathizers in Melbourne have been talking signs reading, "Save Russia, open a second front, long live Russia." An organization called the Friends of the Soviet Union, which was banned early in the war, is now functioning openly. There is no doubt that among Australian workers, the Soviet cause is warmly supported. And in this country, the trade unions exercise a powerful political influence on government. In letters to the editor columns of papers throughout the country, daily appeals to help the Russians are published from the pens of pro-Soviet sympathizers. Considering how remote are the visible interests of Australia and the Soviet Union, the popular feeling for Russia here is really amazing. It is a feeling that will soon be officially recognized by the Australian government, according to reports arriving here from Canberra. For some time, there has been a strong agitation here for diplomatic representation in Moscow, and today's papers publish a report that an Australian military mission may be sent soon to the Soviet Union. The feeling that a Russian collapse might conceivably lead to an Allied defeat, almost certainly lead to a long stalemate, and certainly make the achievement of an Allied victory a matter for years and years of bloody struggle, is not confined to the public alone. Responsible military observers, too, see Russia as the strategic pivot of the United Nations fight against the Axis. They take no pains to conceal their concern at the Russians' touch-and-go position today. This morning, the Sydney Daily Herald neatly summed up the general feeling here like this. I quote, "The greatest risk of all today is that Hitler may succeed in breaking Russia's military power. Were Britain and America to remain impotent spectators of that calamity, the chances of defeating him would be small indeed." This is Martin Agronsky, signing off now from somewhere in Australia.
And here is Richard Harkness of the Washington Bureau of the Philadelphia Inquirer, reporting from our nation's capital.
You've just heard reports from the battlefronts. Washington is a fourth battlefront today, a front where Congress is fighting a pitched battle over inflation. To consumers and taxpayers, this home front is as vital as Russia. It's as grim as Egypt. It's as threatening as China. The administration is colliding head-on with a strong block of senators. Senators from southern, midwestern, and western farm states. Senators who want to curb the authority of Leon Henderson in setting price ceilings. Specifically, the farm bloc wants to forbid Henderson to place a ceiling on any processed or finished product of agriculture. That means dresses and suits, bread and butter, and everything else we eat or wear. The farm bloc doesn't want a price ceiling. Until that ceiling is high enough to ensure their farmers 110% parity for the raw products they raise on the farm back home. Then, there's the amendment giving the Senate veto power over every one of Henderson's price-fixing employees. Employees, that is, making more than $4,500 a year. The plain truth of this is politics. Henderson won't consult senators and representatives in hiring his personnel. Congress wants to say so. It wants the patronage to tell the truth on all these federal jobs. Washington is thrilled today by publication of details how the United States Navy, the Army, and the Marine Corps teamed together in the Battle of Midway last month to crush the Japanese Armada. The score? 20 Japanese ships sunk or damaged. 225 enemy airplanes shot down. Nearly 5,000 Japanese killed. Our losses were slight. One destroyer sunk. The aircraft carrier Yorktown bombed out of action. An undisclosed number of American planes lost. 92 American officers and 215 enlisted men dead. Reports from Moscow are urgent today. But responsible sources in Washington, official sources, that is, are not unduly pessimistic. They admit the situation is dangerous, but they insist it is not hopeless. Let the Germans capture Rostov and Stalingrad, they say. Loss of Russian territory is not important, as long as the Soviet army remains intact, as long as it withdraws in orderly fashion and avoids encirclement by Hitler's invaders. Diplomatic relations between Washington and Vichy are strained today, strained almost to the breaking point by Laval's refusal to bring French battleships at Alexandria to this side of the Atlantic. And that's all from Washington.
We take you now to Moscow.
This is Robert Magidoff speaking from Moscow. The battle for Voronezh is not over yet. On the contrary, it has reached new heights of bitterness. At least 100,000 men and thousands of tanks are now locked in a deadly struggle. It is raging mainly in the narrow stretch between the River Don and the Voronezh River. Both the Russians and the Germans are rushing up reinforcements. In their all-out effort to crash through the Voronezh area, where they've already lost the equivalent of several divisions, the Germans are said to have brought up fresh reserves, not only from other sectors of the Russian front, but also from France and Belgium. A number of divisions recently arrived from there are already in action against Voronezh. German reinforcements keep pouring in by day and night. They are hurled into the battle straight from the march. Thus, the Germans have achieved numerical superiority also on the eastern bank of the Don, making things even more menacing all the way from Voronezh down to Boguchar. That town is some 200 miles to the south, and the Red Army is still on the retreat there. The threat to the Soviet oil and grain supplies has grown further still, while Voronezh itself is in mortal danger. That brave little capital of Russia's black soil region has one hope, however, and that hangs on the hard-hitting Red Army units which have struck against Von Bock's left flank. There, on the northwestern sector of the Voronezh front, the You Can't Stop Me Voroshilov tanks are charging amid blazing woods and fields, treating German tanks as if they were toy things. The Voroshilovs are paving the way for Soviet infantry and Tommy gunners. Racing them are German reinforcements on their way to the threatened sector.
These have been reports by Grant Parr from Cairo, John McVane from London, Richard Harkness from Washington, Martin Agronsky from Australia, and finally from Robert Magidoff in Moscow. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.